Well, let's begin with a word of prayer, shall we? And then let's get into the book of Job, chapter 38, once again. Father, you are glorious. And as we come to listen to you speak, even though you're speaking to Job, you're speaking to us. And you designed it that way because that's why you have this book in your word. And so I pray that just like Job listened, and glory be to you, even his friends listened. And I pray that we will listen and that we will learn the same truths that they gleaned because you spoke. And so work in our hearts, because it's only by your Spirit, using your word, that anything good is accomplished in us, and for which we praise you in Jesus' name. Amen. I mentioned as we closed last week that when we start here in Job chapter 38, God's one technique is just simply to pile on questions. And in fact, we have, if you count them, there are over 70 questions that God just pounds away at with Job. And remember that as we saw in the very first verse, God is speaking specifically to Job. It's not that the three friends might not be able to hear. We aren't told about them in this particular case. But he's speaking for Job's benefit. He's speaking directly to Job, dealing with Job at this moment. He'll deal with the friends later. And he begins to ask questions, and as I pointed out last week, and we took quite a bit of time to stress, God's focus is on creation, on the fact that there is a creation, on the fact that he is the creator. That's his focus, but that's not his goal. And from the very start, I want us to realize his goal in focusing on creation is so that Job could see him, the creator. His goal is to say, Job, you need to realize who you're talking to when you're talking to me. You are talking to God. And we'll see that God very well accomplishes his purpose, as he always does. He accomplishes his purpose very effectively. But we've got to keep that in mind. Yes, he's focusing on creation, but he's focusing on creation because there's a bigger theme underlying creation, and that is the person, the nature of God, who he is. So let's keep that in mind as we go through this. And now let's start with these questions, beginning in verse 4. Well, I'll back up into verse 3. Verse 2. Who is this? God says. Who is this? Let's just stop right there. I just love that approach. The first thing God's going to point out to Job is, who in the world are you? Who do you think you are? And then he makes it even worse. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? You ignoramus. Who do you think you are? God's saying to Job. Right off the bat. Now, then he takes a different facet of it. Now, gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Okay, here's my technique. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions, Job, and see if you can answer me. Where were you, Job, when I laid the foundation of the earth? Man, that's the question I would love to ask many, many professing scientists. Where were you, God's saying? Were you even able to observe what I did when I laid the foundation of the earth? You who think you know so much and you can talk so much about me, where were you, Job? Tell me if you have understanding. Tell me, who set the measurements of the earth, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? And may I point out, God is the master of sarcasm. And that's what we're seeing here. Okay, the literary technique of sarcasm. He's not doing it with a mean spirit, which is unfortunately the way humans usually do. But he is very definitely using the literary technique of sarcasm here. Since you know, Okay? You think you know so much, Job, so you answer my questions. On what were the bases of the earth sunk? Verse 6. Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Don't lose sight of what God's doing here. He's pointing out that the only person who was active creatively was himself. He's the only person. Where were you, Job? You didn't even exist. Well, what about the angels that I had already created, the sons of God who shouted for joy? What did they do? Did they create? No. They just simply praised. They looked at what God was doing and shouted for joy. That's all they did. They had nothing to do with creation, God's pointing out to Job, except to say, wow, what a God. And that's the angels. Who enclosed the sea with its doors? So now he talks not merely about the earth's creation, but now how God continues to develop the water's confinement. And he puts it in terms of childbirth later on. At first, he starts it with construction, I guess you could call it. Who enclosed the sea with doors? Who shut it in at first? And then, who let it burst out? Like, and now his pictures keep changing, you notice. Burst out, it went forth from the womb. So somehow there was a gathering of waters and God just let it cover the earth. When I made a cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed, notice that emphasis, I did this, Job. Where were you? I placed boundaries on the water. I set a bolt in doors and I said, thus far you shall come, but no further. And here shall your proud waves stop. Remember, at first, the waters did cover the earth. And then God separated the waters from the dry land, Genesis 1. That's all God's talking about here is Genesis 1. Where were you when I did that? Could you even keep a drop of water where it belongs, like I've kept all of the waters within the boundaries that I've set for them? That's what God's pointing out here. And then he goes on in verse 12. He moves from the initial creation of the earth to the confinement of the waters. Now in verse 12 through verse 15, he talks about, we could call it the daily sunrise. And notice again how he puts it. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning, Job? Have you ever said, okay, sun, rise, in such a way as to make it rise? Now, we can stand there at X time in the morning and say, okay, sun, rise, and there it comes. But we didn't make it do so. Job didn't make it do so ever. Where were you? Have you ever commanded in your life the morning and caused the dawn to know its place? And then it's an interesting picture that God paints here in verse 13. The dawn, the sunrise, takes place that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. Where do the wicked like to operate? In the dark. That's when most crime takes place, etc. God's saying, yeah, Job, have you ever taken the earth and shaken it so that the wicked start falling out? Which is the picture that he's painting is when light comes, the darkness flees. When light comes, the evil doesn't stop, but it is greatly reduced. What part did you have in that, Job? God's saying. Is it changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like a garment from the wicked? Their light is withheld, and the uplifted arm is broken. Then he moves in verse 16 through verse 18 to what we could call the depths of the earth. And of course, we always think of the netherworld as being inside the earth. And so he addresses that. Have you entered into the springs of the sea? Have you gone down there where the waters come out of the earth into the ocean? Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Anyone know what the deepest level of the ocean that we know of? And it's probably pretty accurate. You know what it is? About 7 miles. Been down there, Job? Of course, you couldn't survive. We can't even send instruments down there. I should say ships. We can't even send vessels down there. because of the water pressure. So have you entered into the springs of the sea? Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Verse 17, then, have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you gotten into the netherworld, Job? Do you even know what I'm talking about, Job? He could be saying there, because the obvious answer is no. Have you understood, verse 18, the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Can you see Job getting smaller and smaller and smaller? I hope we are too. We need to be. That's the whole effect that God is wanting to have on us, is to help us see how small we really are in light of how great He really is. Okay? Then verse 19, he begins to talk about light and darkness. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? This is one of the neat things. All of our scientific advances, and we still don't have a grasp on light. Which means we don't have a grasp on darkness either. So God asked Job, where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? Job, tell me what you know about these things, that you may take it to its territory and that you may discern the path to its home. You know, Job, for you were born then, right? Here comes the sarcasm. And the number of your days is great. Oh, you're so ancient, Job. You must be able to tell me about light and darkness. Well, I'll cover this next time. We're going to cover light and darkness again, so I'll look at it then. Verse 22, he starts talking about what we could call storms. Verse 22, have you entered, Job, the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail? I thought it was interesting. I watched the weather yesterday evening, and the news, the weathercaster, just made the comment about how our rain starts out as tiny crystals of ice up way up there in the sky. We've been able to discover some things, but we can't do anything about it, can we? Not a thing. Have you entered the storehouses? By the way, the word storehouses is used over in Jeremiah chapter 50, verse 25. And this is the idea of the word, as there it's translated armory. It's the place where things are stored, but it's weapons that are stored here. And so the verbal picture of verse 22 is that God can use snow and he can use hail as his weapons. Can we do anything about them? No, we can just put our cars in the garage if the garage doesn't fall down. You see, we're just helpless. We can't do a thing about these things. And then he says, besides calling them armories, so to speak, in verse 22, then he says, about the snow and the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle. God is pointing out, I control these things. They are my weapons. And when I want to send my weapons, I do. Victor.
Can you go back on verse 16? Because all the time when I read this part, what's the difference in the sea and recesses, I think the same?
Recesses of the deep.
What's the difference?
No difference. He's just using multiple ways to talk about the same thing, the depths of the ocean,
that's kind
the deep
of, what I
of
thought,
the earth.
I wasn't too sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, why mention in the 17 the shadow of the dead? I mean, because I ask you sometimes, some people attack you with different weird questions, you know, like this one. Have you seen the gates of the shadow of the dead? How can you explain the shadow of the dead?
I don't see shadow of death here in this verse.
I'm jumping right in 17.
Yeah. I have the gates of death and the gates of deep darkness. I don't see the shadow of death. That I see in Psalm 23.
It's an NIV.
Oh, is that the NIV? Okay. I can never explain NIV. I'm sorry. they're too loose in their translation sometimes, so I don't know what led them to say that. Yeah. You caught me. Just a little. You notice I seldom preach from the NIV, and that's why, because it does take liberties that for an expository preacher can become problems. I'm not decrying it. I'm not talking against it. But it's difficult for an expository preacher to take the way it puts things into phrases and so on and be accurate in our presentation. So that's why I seldom use it. There are times. Now, I have to say, though, since you've already distracted me, I have to say, this is back in the 80s, I think shortly after the NIV first came out. There was a major issue that I found with it in Romans chapter 6. And so I wrote to the board, I wrote to the producers, Zondervan, I think it is, of the NIV, and just said, hey, what in the world are you doing here? And I was so pleased, and I'm not taking credit for this. I'm sure that people much more knowledgeable than I caught that too. But I noticed in the next edition that came out, I noticed that they fixed that. And so I was very, very thankful. What year? I don't know what year. It was sometime in the 80s. I wouldn't be able to specify. So I'm always thankful. I mean, we are humans. We do make mistakes, and I understand that. And it's what do you do when a mistake is pointed out that really is the telling factor. Question, Bill.
What I love about this, what I love about this book is the very thing you're talking about, that God needs to be bigger in our life. Well, He is great and magnificent. And the thrust of this is, we are kind of puny humans, but we tend to puff ourselves up, and it's a great reminder that we should always keep in front of us how big we actually are before God. But the other thing is, and I jotted this down last week, maybe this goes without saying, I'm sure it does, but these chapters are showing how intimately involved God was with his creation. Mm-hmm. Not just that he wound a clock or there was some great explosion, and, you know, this is a day when we place so great a value on science, even as Christians, that we seek to reconcile the Bible with science. In a sense, there's nothing wrong with that, but where there's a difference and a clash, we walk by faith. There's obviously things that we don't know, as evidenced in these chapters. And even as you get later, as we'll go on, we'll talk about animals and God putting wisdom in people. God was intimately involved in every step, not just he got things going and got the ball rolling and everything developed on its own. And this is something, too, that we need to keep in mind. This is something that's part of our, you know, God did it. God did it. It just didn't happen, you know, by just natural causes. Mm-hmm. And God touched his fingers on every part of it.
Well, even when we use the term natural causes or nature, we need to understand that God laid down the rules of what we call nature. He's the one sustaining all that. But let me go back to the first part of your comment. As we see our puniness in light of God's greatness, I would remind you as well of what I've maintained all along is the theme of the book of Job. Why does God want us to see his greatness? It is for our benefit, in addition to being for his glory. What do I mean by that? When we see the greatness of God as he's presenting it here to Job, when we see that, when we grasp it and it grips us, that's when we learn to trust God no matter what. And that's for our benefit. It's for his glory, but it's also very much for our benefit. To trust God, no matter what circumstance, no matter what the situation, no matter what we're fearing for the future, no matter what's happened in the past, learning to trust God, because look at how great he is. He is totally, absolutely trustworthy. That's where God's heading here. That's God's whole point for Job. How dare you not trust me just because you didn't know what I was doing? Well, you've never known what I've done. Look at creation. That's what God's pointing out. You've never known all the things that I've done. You weren't there even. And now you think you've got to know what I'm doing now in order to trust me? No, 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 no. You've lost sight of who I am, God's telling Job. How often do we need to read the book of Job? Maybe 5 times a day or more? You see what I'm saying, though? That's where we're heading, and that's why I'm pointing out these things, is to get us to that realization of the fact that I can trust God. We all know we must. We all know we should, don't we? But God's saying, Job, you can trust me. Okay, verse 24. Where is the way, God says, that the light is divided, or the east wind scattered on the earth? So lightning, part of storms. Wind, part of storms. What do you know about them, Job? Then verse 25, he starts to talk about water in its various forms. Precipitation, as we would call it today. Verses 25 and 26, let me just read them and then make a comment. Who has cleft a channel for the flood or a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land without people, on a desert without a man in it? If a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, does it make a noise? But what's God telling Job here in these two verses? He's saying, Job, have you noticed? Of course, you aren't there, but you know that rain falls where nobody dwells. What's he pointing out? He's pointing out, Job, you aren't the center of the universe. Man is not the center of the universe. I'll send rain where I want to send rain, God says. It might not even benefit man. It might just be that I want to water the sand. I'm God. I do what I want. That's what verses 25 and 26 are saying. I'll send rain where I want to send rain. Verse 27, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the seeds of grass to sprout. If I want to grow flowers in the desert where nobody can see them but me, God says, that's what I'll do. If I want to grow grass in the desert where there aren't any animals to feed, that's what I'll do. He is totally free. Totally free is God. Then verse 28, he says, has the rain a father? Or who has begotten the drops of dew? Okay, now, you remember I said that we're talking about liquid precipitation in all of its forms. So God's just saying, okay, who's the father of rain? Who begot the drops of dew? From whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? So rain, dew, ice, frost, cover the bases. And God says, Job, are you responsible for any of these things? Are you the source of any of these things? Then he goes on, verse 30, water becomes hard like stone. Isn't that amazing? Liquid becomes solid, and the surface of the deep is imprisoned. See if you can do that, Job. I do it every year, God's saying. I do it all the time. Then he goes from the depths of the earth and the earth itself, beginning in verse 31, he talks about the constellations. And interestingly enough, the same names are used that are used today. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? And he's talking about those constellations Can you do anything about those stars, Job? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? You don't even know the ordinances. I don't know about you, but that's one of the things that intrigues me. And I love just checking on the internet periodically to see the latest findings about our vast universe. And of course, a lot of them are guesswork. And you better take it with a lump of salt, maybe a block of salt. But it's still fascinating to find out where science is going in their observations of our universe and the vastness of the universe. And then come back to verse 33. Do you even know the ordinances of the heavens? Do you know how they really operate? Do you know what rules of operation are going on? That's the first part of verse 33. You don't even know them, God's pointing out, and it's still true. It's still so much guesswork for us. But then in the last part of the verse, he says, so did you fix the rules? The rules that you don't even know, did you establish them? That guide the constellations, that guide the galaxies, that guide all that's going on in the vastness of the universe? What is man that thou art mindful of him? Then verse 34, he comes back to some of the forces of nature. Can you lift up your voice to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Okay, Job, can you say, I want lightning to hit that golf course? No. That's what God's asking him. Can you send lightning to hit that tree? No, I can't do that. Who has put wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together? You cannot design. You cannot say, okay, I'll send rain right after the dry season. He's telling Job, I can. I can. Okay, Seth.
I'm sorry, I've been stuck on verse 33. I've got a question. What's the sense of the final phrase? Because it almost sounds as though God's saying, You don't even know the rules by which I govern the entire universe, and can you make those rules actually apply on the earth? I mean, can you, you know, like I'm thinking about like the law of gravity or the laws of thermodynamics or any type of physics where we see that the entire universe, including the earth, operates according to the same rules. Like there's not a different set for space and then a different set for on the earth, and it's who has made them operate the same way. And like that's just kind of the sense that I was getting from the verse. I don't know if that's right to take it that way, you know, because he says this, the ESV, do you know the ordinance of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? Can you make the same things that govern the universe apply on the earth? I was just wondering if you could.
I think that's part of it, but I don't think that's the whole point. Let's face it, we know from Genesis 1 and 2 that while the earth is not the center of the universe as far as astronomy is concerned, and so on, the earth is far from being the center of the universe, and I think that's purposeful. There's another sense in which the earth is the center of the universe. By that I mean that creation, the creation account of Genesis 1 and 2 focuses on the earth. It's where God placed man. And so part of what this 33rd verse is pointing out is that from an earth perspective, the laws of the universe affect us. And we're going back to the constellations, for example. How many millennia did man depend upon the stars as they navigated the oceans especially, or often even land? We're dependent upon the rules of the universe that keep those constellations together and fix us on north and south and east and west and so on. So I think there are many facets to what that 33rd verse is saying, including the one that you've been focused on. Yeah. Okay, then in verse 39, Joe first.
Back up a little bit. I was always kind of curious about this through Scripture, the understanding. In the area that Scripture is written, you know, geographically, snow and ice, where it says the depths are frozen? Well, that's to say their whole ocean is the Mediterranean. I mean, what?
You don't think the Sea of Galilee froze over? I'm joking. how did they get a grasp of it, is what you're asking?
Yeah. I mean, are there mountains in the region that have snow caps?
There are. Mount Hebron has snow on it from time to time and so on. But I think more to the point, I think, is the fact that they can't get a grasp on it. I think God is painting the big picture, and Job may be sitting there saying, what are you talking about? And that's God's whole point. He doesn't understand what God's talking about. So I would say that's more of what's going on. Although I'm sure also that there is some grasp of the concept of snow and ice because of the mountains. Yeah.
Sometimes Jerusalem does get snow.
Well, yeah, and that's today. If we go back 4,000 years, we really don't know much about climate and weather and so on, other than what we see in the Bible. And that's why I'm hesitant to speak too dogmatically about the fact that, yeah, there is snow now. It snowed in Cairo this winter. Really? Interesting. Good. Okay. Now, verse 39. Complete change of subject matter. Same types of questions, but now God comes to the animal kingdom. And so he asked Job, can you hunt the prey for the lion? Can you satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair? So he starts with the lion, and then you notice, and I'm not going to take time to deal with all of them, but he has a long list of animals, and they are simply representative. In verses 39 and 40, he deals with the lion. In verse 41, he deals with the raven and how it feeds its young. In verses 1 through 4 of chapter 39, he deals with the mountain goats and the deer and how they calve, how they give birth. What do you have to do with that, Job? Do you even know when they do it? Then verses 5 and following, 5 through 8, he deals with the wild donkeys. In verses 9 through 12, he deals with what is here called the wild ox. We think it's the now extinct animal, the auroch. If you are interested in that kind of thing, it's very possibly the auroch that he's talking about. In verses 9 through 12. Verses 13 through 18, he deals with the ostrich. Verses 19 through 25, I will take a moment here to discuss. He says, do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed and does not turn back from the sword. So you realize what God is primarily talking about here is what we would call the charger, the war horse, the horse that's used in battle. And of course, that was by far the most important tool, so to speak, other than the weapons themselves, the sword and the spear, the bow and the arrow. That horse was so very important in ancient times. That's how they moved fast, that's how they got up high, that the strength of the horse could determine the outcome of the battle. And so God is saying, well, how do you handle the horse? Did you make him? Can you make him who he is? And so on. Then in verse 26, he deals with the hawk, probably what we would know of as the sparrow hawk. And in verses 27 through 30, He deals with what is called the eagle, which, according to the description here, we think is the griffon vulture, which is the largest bird of prey in the Middle East and often called an eagle over there. So God just takes these representatives of the animal kingdom and says, Job, what do you have to do with any of these things? Did you make them? Can you control them? Can you handle anything about them? And this is where we find God closes this part of his speech and makes the application in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 40. Then the Lord said to Job, and get this, because this is the whole point. Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Notice what he calls himself here, Shaddai, the Almighty. You're, Job, you who don't know anything, much less can do anything about creation, you're going to find fault with the Almighty, the one who made these things, the one who controls these things, all of the universe. Will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. If you think you can say the things you've said about me, Job, answer all these questions I've just asked you. Then you'll have the right. If you can answer these questions, then you might start finding fault with me. Talk about wanting to crawl in a hole. Victor.
I got two questions for you. One is we go back to 39 verse 9. I always thought about any animal we have around us that are really friendly. Isn't that all used to be wild? And we make it come close and close and close to us, and we have a really friendly animals around us, like a horses, cows, dog, whatever.
I think that's an assumption that cannot be proven. In fact, I would suggest that that has not ever been the case. That all animals have been wild. I don't see any evidence of that. I think we're giving ourselves way too much credit. I'm not saying we can't tame animals. But, for example, the wild ox here, the auroch, I don't know that there was ever any that was ever tamed. But since they're extinct, we're pretty ignorant of them.
So the other one is, when mentioned about the darkness, I keep boiling my head like right now, we have a daylight right here, but sometime in some place of the earth, it is nighttime right now.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when the Lord separated the darkness and the light, the whole world used to be dark. I mean, it don't have a sun. The sun don't exist in that time.
Oh, that's what I was going to... I never got to that, did I? That's what I was going to point out. We see light and darkness, and our whole conception of them is if there's light, there has to be a light bearer. There has to be a sun or an electric bulb or some source of light. But if you go back to Genesis 1, you find out that light existed without a light bearer. There was no sun, there were no stars, there were no light bulbs. There was just light. We can't grasp that. We just don't have a way of digging into that. But that's one of the things that I think points us to the greatness of our God. He understands light, we don't.
Thank you.
Yeah, what more can be said? Joe.
I did a search once on Google on light, and what prompted me was I am the light of the world. That's a search that if you even try to grasp what you just said, what light is, without a source, It blows your mind.
Taking that a step further, let's go to the new heavens and the new earth and the new Jerusalem. And we find the answer to this conundrum. What is the source of our light in the New Jerusalem? It is the presence of God. What more do we need to know? See? And that's the whole point of what God is doing with Job. I am the, as Tim was praying this morning, I'm the beginning and the end. And he shows that in so many ways. Good. Okay, so the point that God has been making with Job there in verse 2, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. And so we come to verses 3 through 5, and remember I called this heading, God speaks and Job shuts up. Obviously, God's speaking is the vast majority of this section. Verses 3 through 5 are where Job shuts up. Notice what he says in doing so. Then Job answered the Lord and said, talk about an understatement. Behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? He's left speechless. What can be said when I have been given that vision of God, of the Almighty? I've spoken once, but I will not answer. I've spoken twice to my chagrin. I will add nothing more. There is nothing for me to say in light of this vision of the greatness of the Creator God. I think that's fantastic. But I'm also very intrigued with the fact that when Job shuts up, God's not done. And so you notice when we come to verse 6, we read, then the Lord answered Job out of the storm. Same storm, in other words. The same whirlwind is going on. But just because Job has said, I give up, doesn't mean God is done with him. And it shows the seriousness of the matter at hand, that God is not done with Job. It shows the seriousness of us getting a grasp on the greatness of God. That God doesn't just say, okay, Job, I think you got the point. No, he drives that nail way deep into the wood. The head's down there, stuck in there some by the time God's done. Because he is not, it's too important a matter to have the proper view of God. That's what we need to realize by the fact that we have chapters 40 through 41, where God comes back at him. So God speaks, and we'll see that there is actually more. Job has only shut up. There's more that needs to take place in Job, and that's why God is doing what he's doing. So beginning in verse 7, God again challenges Job to teach him. He says, now gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you and you instruct me. Okay, here's my technique. More questions. Give me the answers, Job. Teach me. Verse 8, he challenges not only Job to teach him, he challenges, now he's starting to get specific. He's painted the big picture of his greatness. Now he says, I challenge your charges against me, Job. You've made charges against me. And now I'm going to hold you to answer for them. Verse 8, will you really annul my judgment? Put it in different words, because we use the word judgment differently than it's so frequently used in the Bible. He's basically saying, Job, will you discredit my fairness? Will you discredit my justice? Will you even suggest that I may be operating in a way that is not just? Will you really annul my judgment? Or to take it a step further, will you condemn me so that you may be justified? Are you willing, Job, to be so focused on your innocence? Are you willing to be so focused on the fact that I didn't sin to deserve what I'm getting, that you're willing to even suggest, or that you're willing to even drop hints that I should be condemned? Are you willing to do that, Job, in light of who you've seen me to be? Can you even think about insinuating that I might be unjust, Job? I would guess that most of us, if not all of us, can see ourselves in Job's sandals right now, can't we? Then he, in verse 9, he challenges Job's brashness in criticizing him. Job, you have been so brash in being willing to even in the least way criticize how I have operated. But he does so in a very interesting way. He does so, he says, Job, I challenge your brashness in criticizing me because, first of all, you lack my power. Verse 9, Job, do you have an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Match my power, Job. Go ahead and try. Or verse 10. He points out, Job, you lack my splendor. Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, Job. Clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Do you come close to my honor? Do you come close to my majesty, Job? Do you have any right at all to speak the way you've spoken, Job? Verse 11. He challenges the brashness that Job has been expressing. Since Job lacks God's ability to punish the wicked. I'm fascinated by this. Verses 11 through 13, especially. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Go ahead, Job, do that. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him and tread down the wicked where they stand. Go ahead, Job, do that. Verse 13, hide them in the dust together, bind them in the hidden place. What's God's point there? Job had complained in his speeches with the friends. Job had been complaining that God didn't always punish the wicked. Now, he'd been doing so in such a way as to point out to the friends how wrong they were in their arguments. But he was still complaining because he was viewing the unjustness of life from his perspective. What God's doing is saying, Job, you've been complaining that I haven't always punished the wicked in this life? Well, let's see, Job, can you even do that? Can you do that, Job? Can you punish the wicked in this life? Not just do you have the authority, he's saying, do you even have the power? So who are you to question what I do and the wisdom that I am exercising in the way that life is going? Whoa. It's getting quiet in here, isn't it? Because we all begin to recognize we have pulled the same stunts as Job did. And now we're beginning to see God's attitude about that. And that's a good thing. Don't dwell on the past. Recognize the mistakes we've made. But let what we're seeing here guide us going forward. Let it guide us now. Let it guide us in the days to come. Let it guide our minds and let it guide our mouths in being really, really careful about our perception of God and therefore our attitude toward God. Okay. Then God's message in verses 15 through the end of chapter 41. Is basically a twofold message. And again, you notice God just doesn't get away from creation. In verses 15 through 24 here of chapter 40, he says, Job, I want you to consider the behemoth. You say, what's that? I don't know. And anyone who thinks they know doesn't know. Okay? And so many people are trying to particularly identify and say, it's got to be this. No, it doesn't got to be that. There are so many animals that existed that we don't even know about yet. God, don't limit God. Whatever animal, let's get the point that he's making, not get caught up in having to identify it. Now, having said that, what I would suggest is that it was probably a large hippopotamus-like beast. It may have been 20 times larger than a hippopotamus, for all I know. It might have been one of those big I don't know. But the point that he's making is really important. The point that he's making, verse 15, is that, first of all, this behemoth was made by God. Consider, behold now, behemoth, which I made, as well as making you, Job. I made you both. He eats grass like an ox. So he's grass eating. And then the power of this beast, whatever it is what God emphasizes in verses 16 through 18. Look at his strength in his loins. Look at the power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. I would have said it's a rhinoceros type of creature, except that God doesn't talk about a horn or anything. But the reason I would wish I could say a rhinoceros is because this week I watched a video of a battle between a rhinoceros and a hippo. And I watched that rhinoceros just mutilate. I mean, just devastate that hippo. And I'm looking, and you know how big a hippo is. I mean, full grown, I'm talking about. And that rhinoceros with its head and that horn, it just did him in. I'm looking at that saying, whoa, God made this. The power. I mean, all that, they'd only need 1 foot crunching down on me and I'd be dead. God made these. Look at the power here, and that's what God wants us to get. And whatever this behemoth is, verses 19 through 24, he is very secure in his environment. He's the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food. All the beasts of the field play there. Under the lotus plants he lies down in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. The lotus plants cover him with shade and the willows of the brook surround him. That's why I'm talking about a hippopotamus-like creature, because of the environment that God paints for him. If a river rages, he's not alarmed. He's confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. So the whole point here is this is an animal that's very comfortable in his environment.
It seems to me that it does matter a little bit what kind of animal this was, because maybe not for the story of Job, but for the story of modern thinking, because it kind of, if it turns out that this creature is a dinosaur, for example, which I would argue it is because of the cedar-like tail, it shows something really interesting about our perception of history, because evolution says dinosaurs have been dead for millions of years. If this, in fact, was a dinosaur, then they were alive with man. So I think that is worth talking about.
From that perspective, it still makes no difference to me as to the identity of the animal. But from that perspective, yes, I agree with you that it does make a difference to realize that these animals, whatever they be, are known. They are known. So I have no problem with that. Yeah. Okay, the next animal that he covers in verses 1 through 34 of chapter 41. Oops, time's up. So we'll cover Leviathan, or Leviathan, as many like to say. We'll have to cover that starting next Sunday. Do you see God a little bit bigger? If not, it's been a waste of time. Jeremy, if we can get the mic to Ryan, he wants to have the closing word.
I actually have a question. Just could you speak a bit more about, you said there was 2 points about this last creature. You said, one, he was made by God, and two, you said he's comfortable in his environment. Could you just talk a bit more about that second point? Why is that significant, and what does that mean exactly?
Okay, it simply means that God made this creature so powerful that he doesn't fear anybody. He's not afraid of where he's going to find something to eat. He's not afraid of being attacked. And again, it comes back to the fact that God made him that way. God made those that are afraid of being attacked and those that do struggle to find something to eat too. But for his purposes with Job, he's saying, look at, I made this, and look at what I made. So. And having talked about rain, oh God, the one who's sending this rain right now, rain that we can observe, a rain about which we've learned much, but a rain that we cannot control at all. We want to come to you and give you praise. We want to come to you and thank you for these reminders that you gave Job and that you gave us, that you are truly the God who can be trusted and must be trusted no matter what. For you and you alone are worthy. Help us to see that if we are not trusting you, then we are trusting something that is not worthy. May you be worshipped today more fervently than ever before as a result of what we're seeing here in Job. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.